Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, though the weeds you are about to enter are dense, you'll have an excellent guide and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Cole. Still, this brief primer may aid you. When the United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001, it entered historically treacherous territory. Foreign powers had often found themselves bogged down in the region. The objective was to defeat Al-Qaeda and remove the Taliban from power. One of the main players in the conflict was the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, an organization ranked among the top intelligence agencies in the world. Directorate S is the covert action arm of the ISI. Steve Cole is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book, a sequel to his Pulitzer Prize winner, Ghost Wars, is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, 2001 to 2016. His new work, he writes, seeks to provide a thorough, reliable history of how the CIA, ISI, and Afghan intelligence agencies influenced the rise of a new war in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, and how that war fostered a revival of Al-Qaeda, allied terrorist networks, and eventually branches of the Islamic State. Steve Cole spoke at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium on February 15th. His appearance was co-presented by the LA Bay Book Company and Town Hall Seattle. Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the talk. We're presenting our podcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Steve Cole is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. From 2007 to 2013, he was the president of the New America Foundation, a public policy institute in Washington, D.C. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and previously worked for 20 years at the Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism in 1990. He's the author of seven other books, including On the Grand Trunk Road, The Bin Ladens, and Private Empire. But his latest book, Directorate S, is a chronicle of the history of the CIA and its involvement in the war in Afghanistan, and the subject of tonight's talk. Please join me in welcoming Steve Cole.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming out. I'm looking forward to hearing from you a little bit later, but I'll give you a sense of some of the flavor and narrative and themes in this book, and we'll go from there. So on February 15th, 1989, the final armored column of the limited contingent of Soviet forces in Afghanistan, as the Soviet occupation force called itself, crossed over the Friendship Bridge above the Amu Darya River, officially ending Soviet combat operations in the country. So General Boris Gromov was the final Soviet commander of the war, and he sat in the column's last armored personnel carrier, and then in the middle of the bridge, he got out and climbed down, and without looking back at Afghanistan, walked the rest of the way to be met by his teenage son, who gave him a bouquet of flowers. So toward the end of 2014, President Obama declared that the United States combat war in Afghanistan would also end, and he and his cabinet asked the then commanding general, John Campbell, in Kabul, to do something to mark the end of the war, what they thought was the end of the war. But they weren't leaving the country. They were staying to advise and assist the Afghan security forces. And the war wasn't going especially well, so they didn't want to call much attention to themselves with a public event. So they staged the departure ceremony in a gymnasium inside the bunkered compound of the International Security Assistance Force headquarters in Kabul. They handed out a program to everyone who came that included instructions about how to lay down in the event of a rocket attack. So it was not a glorious end of the war, and it turned out not to actually be the end of the war, because a year later, when the Islamic State popped up in eastern Afghanistan, President Obama ordered the U.S. forces back into direct combat against that part of the opposition to the constitutional government. Today we're fighting two wars in Afghanistan, one against the Islamic State that has a certain kind of framework of rules and direct combat by the U.S., and the other, an advise and assist war, helping the Afghan security forces wage their war against the Taliban and essentially acting as their air force as well as their kind of intelligence service. So this is the story of how we got from 9/11 to here, to this mess, this stalemate. And at the center of the story, though by no means the only part of it, is the Pakistani Intelligence Service, ISI, which was a factor both in the defeat of the Soviet occupation and in the struggles that the United States and its European allies have had since 2005 particularly. So Directorate S is the covert action arm of the ISI that has supported groups like the Taliban, Kashmiri militants, and others. It was really strengthened during the 1980s when the CIA and Saudi Arabia collaborated with ISI and with Directorate S to funnel guns and money to the Afghan Mujahideen. But after that war ended, after the Soviets left, Pakistan had discovered this strategy of using these militias to menace India in particular. So it started to apply the lessons it had learned in the Afghan war as a collaborator of the CIA to its problems in Kashmir. And then as the Afghan civil war worsened, the Taliban rose and Pakistan basically patronized the Taliban as they took over all of Afghanistan, and ISI was central to that project. So, you know, this was not a mystery to the United States. Far from it, ISI and even its covert action wing had been collaborators with the CIA. And yet when it became apparent that ISI was back in action, this time against American forces and NATO forces, as I say, around 2005, certainly by 2006, two administrations, the Bush administration and then the Obama administration, really struggled to do anything about it. There's a character in the book who was a CIA station chief in Kabul a few times and eventually ran the agency's counterterrorism center named Chris Wood. And when he was station chief in Kabul around 2011, a lot of members of Congress or senators who were visiting would go in and get an hour with him. And he had he used this to basically impress upon them that the whole war was falling apart because of the sanctuary that the Taliban enjoyed in Pakistan. And he used to say, we either address this sanctuary and we win the war, or we don't, and we lose the war. It's that simple. Now, I'm not sure that it's that simple, but that was the kind of obvious flaw in the way the war was going that just persisted year after year, despite being well known and well recognized. Neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration could find the will or the way to change that equation. So why? Why did we fail to achieve our aims in Afghanistan, besides the problem of Directorate S, or including the problem of Directorate S? I want to talk about four areas where we failed ourselves, failed our allies, failed the Afghans that we made promises to. One is the problem of our war aims, which have been confused and laced with contradictions really almost since the fall of the Taliban in early 2002. The second was the failure of our relationship with longtime Afghan President Hamid Karzai and of our investments in democratic Afghan politics more broadly. The third is the illusions of the big, heavy counterinsurgency war that we fought between 2008, 2012, or 13. And finally, the failure of our political and diplomatic strategy to resource it, but to carry one out that would perhaps reduce the violence in the war. So let me start with the problem of our war aims. One of the things that gets chronicled in this story is the fact that in both the late Bush administration and the Obama administration, the war cabinet, the interagency kind of planners for American military and foreign policy, must have carried out at least half a dozen classified strategy reviews to try to figure out how to fix what was going sideways in the war. And one thing that I was sort of amused to discover is that these reviews, one year after another, pretty much all took place in the same classified conference room on the fourth floor of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next door to the West Wing. Be a different group of people who would come in, but the reviews pretty much all worked the same way. In the morning, they go on for days, in the morning the intelligence professionals would come in and brief the decision makers about, say, the political demography of the region, or the CIA made these maps every 6 months where they would color each of Afghanistan's 400 administrative districts a different color to indicate whether the government controlled it, the Taliban controlled it, it was contested, or it was independently controlled. And these were very popular maps, and they would sit at the table and pore over them and talk about how to move the colors by changing their strategy. But there were fundamental problems that recurred in these reviews about the whole purpose of the American war in Afghanistan. In 2009, for example, during the Obama administration's two long and you know, painful reviews of the war, one in the spring and one in the autumn, the cabinet there, the principals and the deputies who attended these meetings, they wrestled with the question that you would hope government decision makers would wrestle with when they're sending young American men and women to war, which is, what are the vital interests that the United States has in this war, so vital as to justify the sacrifices that we're asking young men and women to make in combat? And they really took that question seriously. They argued about it. Not all of them had the same view, but they settled on two vital interests in 2009. One was al-Qaeda, which was still very active, attempting and sometimes carrying out attacks across borders in Europe, attempting attacks in the United States. It was it was maybe 1,000 volunteers at most, and it still seemed dangerous enough to warrant military action. And the second vital interest that they identified was the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Pakistan has 100 plus nuclear weapons and dozens of millenarian terrorist groups on its soil, and the fear was that if those weapons got into the wrong hand, it could be a real catastrophe, and so it was vitally important to make sure that didn't happen. Okay, let's think about those two vital interests. In 2009, whether we accept them or we partially accept them, one thing is irrefutable about them. Neither problem was located in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda had migrated from Afghanistan to Pakistan. They had fled Afghanistan during the bombing of 2001 and relocated across the border. And of course, the problem of Pakistan's nuclear weapons is in Pakistan. And the group rationalized this problem by saying, well, if we don't go into Afghanistan to stabilize that country and reverse the course of the war, then Afghanistan will fall apart and al-Qaeda will come back. So that's the reason we have to do this, even though as you can see, it's a rather indirect and even speculative reason to fight a war, to send soldiers into rural Kandahar to step over IED tripwires. The other contradiction that surfaced was basically whether or not the Taliban should be understood as an enemy of the United States, and whether we really it was in our interest to try to defeat them. This part of the conversation started with a sense of realism. Even Bob Gates, who was the Secretary of Defense at the beginning of the Obama administration, holdover from the Bush administration, he said, look, the Taliban are part of Afghanistan. They may be abhorrent. They may be coercive. They may have revolutionary aims, but they are 25,000 strong, and they are part of the fabric of the country. There is no way that we're going to defeat them militarily at a cost or on a timeline that's acceptable to us. And in any event, there were no Afghans on the plains on September 11th. The Taliban had never carried out a cross-border, out-of-area terrorist attack against the United States. They fought the United States, they said, because the United States came into their country and they were going to liberate it from foreign occupation as they saw it. So there was this big debate in the Situation Room. Well, have we ever really said that we're going to defeat the Taliban? Because President Obama really did not want to fight a war against the Taliban. He did not want to embroil the United States into a long, grinding war against an indigenous extremist group that was rooted in the countryside. And a number of his advisors agreed with him about that, but they were still going to send tens of thousands of Americans into Afghanistan to pursue the vital interests that were located in Pakistan. And when they got to Afghanistan, they were going to find the Taliban. And there were a lot of folks at the Pentagon, generals, commanders, who had been out there and had fought in Afghanistan, and they really did want to fight the Taliban. They kind of wanted to finish the war or at least beat the Taliban down. So they got into this argument about whether this was really a commitment that the United States had ever made. And the next day, the Pentagon team came into the room with a PowerPoint deck, and they put up slides of every statement that American presidents and senators and others had made promising to defeat the Taliban. So they said, no, you may not want to do it, but you've said you're going to do it. So in the end, they settled this argument by defining as a goal reversing the Taliban's momentum, degrading the Taliban. You know, if any of you are English teachers grading papers or editors trying to put a magazine to bed, that's not precise enough language to be satisfactory. It's not the kind of language you use to send people into combat. Now, you could say that this is a subjective standard and an indefinite one. You know, a more generous way to describe what was decided was that they did not feel that they could afford to allow Afghanistan to collapse. They had not made an adequate effort to train up the Afghan army or the police. They should have done that by 2009, but the job was unfinished, and so they were going to go in to fight in order to buy enough time to hand the war off to the Afghans. It might be another American war that you'll remember where that was kind of the theory of the case. So I talk about, there's a chapter in the book titled Losing Karzai, which is kind of what happened during the period 2009-2010. You know, it's become fashionable to think of Hamid Karzai as unstable, you know, consumed by conspiracy theories. And there's no question that during the time that he was our partner in this war, with all this sacrifice, all this expenditure, that he was, his behavior in private was you know, unbalanced. But why did Karzai come to doubt the intentions of the United States, and Britain for that matter? One of the reasons was he could not understand why the United States allowed ISI to persist with its interference in the war and its support for the Taliban. I covered the war as kind of a beat reporter for The New Yorker. I was over there a lot. I've interviewed Karzai a couple of times. And I was surprised when I went back to really excavate as much of the detail of who said what to whom when and how these decisions were made for the book, to discover that essentially Karzai was very consistent right from the time that he became president. Anytime an American came to visit him, he would say, the war's in Pakistan, you gotta do more about ISI. Why aren't you putting more pressure on ISI? And he would organize his cabinet to basically say this again and again every time a new American came into the picture. When candidate Obama visited Afghanistan for the first time in the summer of 2008, Karzai and his cabinet planned for this opportunity. They could see that Obama might become president. And they all decided that even though they were kind of fighting with one another about a lot of subjects, that they would use this meeting with candidate Obama to basically all say, the problem is ISI, you gotta do more about ISI, and one after another around the table. And Senator Obama asked if, you know, there was a way that Pakistan civilian leaders could curb the ISI, and Karzai said, not without the help of the United States. The problem is ISI, which runs the country. So what developed was that Karzai took it for granted that the United States, as the world's, you know, supreme military superpower, could force ISI to stop aiding the Taliban if it really wanted to do so. And since the U.S. didn't do this, he sunk into conspiracy thinking that there had to be another explanation as to why they weren't doing this. And eventually he concluded that the U.S. was secretly conspiring to allow ISI to destabilize Afghanistan so that it could justify maintaining military bases in the country for an indefinite period. Now, this conspiracy theory really frustrated the Americans, especially when the stakes got high as they were negotiating their departure with Karzai's government. And at one point, in 2013, a special envoy from the State Department named James Dobbins went to visit Karzai to try to get him off this idea that the United States was deliberately allowing ISI to destabilize Afghanistan. And Dobbins said to him, you know, Mr. President, between Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks, you know, you've got several million documents to examine. Can you find any mention of this design? And Karzai paused and he looked at him and said, maybe you don't know the plan. He said, you know, there is a deep state in America. So the frustrations built up, and Karzai had another reason to be paranoid about the US, and that was the 2009 presidential election. At the end of his first five-year term, he was up for re-election in August of 2009. And during the run-up to that vote, Richard Holbrooke, who was the special envoy out of the State Department initially on the diplomatic side, started to very indiscreetly recruit candidates to run against Karzai. He talked to Ashraf Ghani, he talked to Hanif Atmar, he talked to virtually and encouraged them to get in the race, run. Now, you can't be a minister in a country like Afghanistan and not take an invitation like that as some kind of signal that maybe the US is going to conspire to put you into office. They also all were concerned that Karzai would think that they were betraying him, and so they immediately reported these conversations to Karzai, who heard all about it. There's a scene where Holbrooke's in Kabul, and there's he runs into a guy named Ahmad Zia Massoud, who ended up as a vice president of Afghanistan, who's a brother of the deceased commander Ahmad Shah Massoud. And Ahmad Zia says to him, you know, I think I am the only significant person in Kabul who you have not asked to run for president. I think I feel insulted. But the truth was that Holbrooke, described diplomacy as like jazz, it was a kind of improvisation. He had no authorization from the White House to do this, and he had no plan to actually replace Hamid Karzai. And so at the end of the election crisis, which required, you know, band-aid diplomacy and a lot of activity just to save it, we ended up with the worst of both worlds. Karzai was back in office for 5 years, and he was correctly convinced that the US had tried to unseat him. So you add that to his frustrations about ISI, and it's not surprising that he started to become a little unbalanced. Around this time, he goes for a walk in the Arg Palace, where he lives and works, kind of a house arrest in this compound because of the security situation. He can't move around very much. So people come to visit him. Sometimes he would walk in circles in his garden, and he goes for a walk with one of his ministers. He's particularly frustrated with the Americans. And he says, If we can't run the government, we should just bring the Taliban back to punish both the Americans and the Panjshiris, referring to the Northern Alliance. Karzai's young son, Mirwais, happened to be with him. And the minister asks him, do you want this boy to grow up under a Taliban regime? I don't want that for my son. He said, you know, Mr. President, you're right. The Americans have not been fair to you. At the beginning, they called you an Afghan Mandela. Now they call you an Afghan Mugabe. This is too much. But we have to admit we've made our mistakes. We have to take responsibility for our part of this. And if the government in Kabul collapses, he went on, the US will not be threatened, but we will all be wiped out. And that's what kept Karzai on side, his dependency on the international system for his own life, his security, his government. And he resented being a ward of the international system. And he saw himself toward the end have an opportunity to kind of write himself into Afghan history as to someone who did not act in alliance with the US. And so he became more and more defiant for some of these reasons. There's more to say about the failure of our strategy in Afghan constitutional politics, but I'll just mention one other reason why Karzai was no longer a reliable partner by the time he left office in 2014. When the Obama administration came in, they felt that the Bush administration had coddled Karzai. In fact, I think George W. Bush had built a successful relationship with Karzai. He talked to him on the video conference every couple of weeks. He kept reassuring him. Karzai never really acted out because he had this lifeline right into the White House. But the Obama administration thought that this was a form of dependency that they needed to break, that they needed to pressure Karzai into improving his own performance in corruption and governance and in the drug trafficking problem. And you can understand why they thought that. But the way they delivered the message wasn't very effective. So Joe Biden goes out to the region, he goes to Islamabad, then he flies into Kabul, and he sits down with Karzai in the Arg Palace. And Karzai says to him the same thing he says to everyone, you know, the issue is ISI, the issue is Pakistan, you've got to put more pressure on them. And Biden replies, Mr. President, Pakistan is 50 times more important to the United States than Afghanistan. You know, it goes back to those vital interests. That's probably what he had in mind. Maybe not the most diplomatic way to describe it to the president of Afghanistan. So, counterinsurgency. I mean, President Obama inherited a terrible situation. The war was falling apart. The Bush administration had done a strategy review in which it recommended a troop escalation. He's inaugurated in January 2009 in the midst of the worst recession in half a century. And the first thing that happens is that a bunch of generals come into his office and say, Mr. President, you gotta send more troops to Afghanistan, you gotta do it now because of the election schedule. We can't wait, it takes time to get them out there. And Biden and Holbrooke, who had been around and for whom Vietnam kind of lingered in the background, said, you know, Mr. President, don't be pressured by these generals. Let's stop, let's pause, let's think about it. But Obama had campaigned on a promise to fix the Afghan war. He had made the point that the Iraq war was a strategic fiasco and that Al-Qaeda was the real threat to the United States and it was at issue in the Afghan war. So he had kind of boxed himself in with the campaign narrative. And the schedule was what it was. And then the president became estranged from Holbrooke, his principal regional advisor. He found Holbrooke kind of too big of a personality, self-dramatizing. Holbrooke was a big personality and self-dramatizing and quite a, you know, quite an acquired taste in Washington. But he was very experienced and very smart, and he, one of the problems that opened up between him and the president was that he kept talking about Vietnam, where he had served in the Mekong Delta. And Obama made it very plain that he didn't want to hear about this comparison. This was not Vietnam. This was not the 1960s. This was a different set of problems. And, you know, I was reporting at this time and keeping all my diaries and notes and things. And when I went back through all my conversations with Holbrooke, I remember him talking after he'd just come out of a discussion with the president in which the president had reprimanded him for talking about Vietnam. And he admitted that he had hurt himself by doing this. But then he said, they shouldn't be so afraid of history. Well, one of the parts of history that they shouldn't have been so afraid of was the outlandish claims that were made by the generals that Obama inherited about the potential of counterinsurgency doctrine to reshape the war, to connect Afghans to their government, to create a lasting change in the attitudes of the Afghan civilian population toward the Taliban, to separate the Taliban from the population in the very places where the Taliban had risen. And in Washington, if you pass through in those years, there was kind of a bubble, like a tulip bubble or a Bitcoin bubble around counterinsurgency doctrine. They had just carried out this successful surge into Baghdad, led by General Petraeus. He was a very powerful and charismatic figure, an intellectual of sorts, certainly had a PhD. And he really persuaded a lot of people in Washington that if they just applied counterinsurgency doctrine to the Afghan war, they would get a positive result. One of the problems with counterinsurgency is you need a lot of troops to carry it out. The typical kind of analysis is that you need a ratio of 20 soldiers and police to every 1,000 inhabitants to create the kind of security and presence necessary. And if you did that math in Afghanistan, then you'd need 600,000 troops, and that wasn't going to happen. There were no Afghan forces of that scale at that time, and the U.S. force could escalate, but certainly not to that size. So to solve this in the same conference room in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, they basically just changed the math problem. They identified 80 key terrain districts, as they called them, where they would fight the counterinsurgency war. These were the districts in Taliban country that they thought were most important to subdue. And they basically created this overdetermined engineering diagram that birthed a lot of jargon-filled language about district stability frameworks. And I went to a Pentagon briefing during this time, and I wrote down in my notebook what the colonel said in explaining how this was going to work. And he said, it's great to make sure the population is attached to the government, which almost sounded like a kind of Soviet workers' slogan of some sort. It was so abstract and rote. The mantra was clear, hold, build, transfer, meaning transfer territory rid of Taliban influence to a legitimate Afghan government and its security forces. So you can see the abstract modeling of how that would work. But as Sherard Coper Coles, the British envoy, who had had 2 years of hard experience in Kabul as ambassador, told his counterparts that summer of 2009, Afghan capacity is an illusion. The entire sequence of hold, build, transfer is based on wishful thinking. The White House war czar at the time was a guy named Doug Lute, a two-star general who had become the main National Security Council advisor on Afghanistan. And you know, he's a West Point graduate. He was a military operations man. He'd served in Iraq and other places. And the way he explained it to President Obama was he said, you know, Mr. President, you can send a battalion of U.S. Marines not only anywhere in Afghanistan, but literally anywhere in the world, and they will clear an area. And as long as you're willing to keep them there, they'll hold it. The problem is handing it to the Afghans and doing something with it. Now, by the end of 2009, though he never said so in public, I think it was plain to a lot of people around him that President Obama had lost faith in the promises of this counterinsurgency doctrine, and he wanted to start coming home. That's why at West Point in December of that year, he announced both a surge of U.S. combat troops that would ultimately number more than about 100,000 U.S. troops and 150,000 international combat troops at the peak in 2011. But he announced that decision, and then he also announced the date at which these troops would start coming home. So we were going in, and we were coming out. Now, what this left on the ground was a really difficult fight for the soldiers, the infantry, the Marines, who were sent into these key terrain districts to try to clear them so that they could be held, so that they could be transferred and built. And since I'm doing okay on time, I'll read you something. The narrative is mostly set, you know, in the Arg Palace, in the Army headquarters, ISI headquarters, in the Situation Room, in the U.S. Decision-making venues. But I also tried to intersperse reporting and narrative on the ground so that it wasn't just a story of decision-makers, but also of the consequences of these decisions. And so there's a chapter here called Lives and Limbs, which is about one of the very hardest fights that happened during the counterinsurgency phase of the war, which was to the west of Kandahar in this irrigated zone south of Highway 1 between Kandahar and Helmand. And in the summer, because of the fertile irrigation system, it's called the Green Zone. It becomes very dense with vegetation, grapes, 10-foot-tall marijuana plants was one feature of it, and vegetation that was just very difficult to walk through. And the Taliban had been embedding inside this foliage for years, preparing for the Americans. They'd outlasted attempts to kind of clear them out of this ground before, and the U.S. came in the summer of 2010, determined to do it. But by this time, the military was so strained because of the deployments to Iraq and now the escalation in Afghanistan that they were having to improvise with the kinds of forces they put into this environment. So this little passage is about an artillery unit called the 1/320th that was made up of soldiers who had not been trained to fight infantry. They'd been trained to fight from bases, from a distance with big guns, you know, the precision of firing artillery from far from contact. But because they didn't have enough infantry, they converted this artillery unit into an infantry unit. And I'll just read you a few paragraphs about what their experience was like. The initial phase of Colonel Art Kandarian's campaign in the Green Zone wasn't much different from that of the U.S. Army in the American West during the 19th century. Build forts in Indian country and poke around. The task force's engineering units designed a crude combat outpost, a COP or COP, as it was instantly rendered in jargon, that could be erected in 10 to 14 days. The outposts were usually about 200 meters by 250 meters in area. The outer walls were made of Hesco gabions, manufactured blast walls of dirt held together by mesh wire, 11 feet high and 7 feet thick. Combat engineers also erected tall observation towers where soldiers on watch could look out directly at this canopy of thick green foliage. It was sometimes easier for the Taliban to spot the Americans in the towers than vice versa, however. In June, a Taliban sniper killed Brandon King of the 1/320th, shooting him square in the face as he stood on watch in one of these towers. Forward American units detained suspected insurgents and used retinal scanners to log them in classified databases. But interrogations and human intelligence collection in Kandahar that summer rarely produced insights beyond the known fact that many Taliban fighters were from or trained in Pakistan. The more useful tactical intelligence about Taliban positions and movements came from listening to their radio communication. The enemy had no means to encrypt their chatter, which was easily intercepted and translated. The monitoring allowed American platoons to anticipate ambush attempts and to stay ahead of the Taliban's reactions during combat. Platoons depended on their most experienced sergeants to survive. Sergeant Josh Strickland had served two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan before joining 3rd Platoon A Battery of the 1/320th, the Artillery Misfits. During his first couple of weeks at combat outpost Nolan, Strickland's patrols could not walk 100 yards without hitting an IED or getting lit up by Taliban from several sides. Listening to the enemy radio talk, they learned the enemy knew they were artillery, not infantry. The Taliban said, "These are not real war fighters." They were wrong, but it took time and heavy losses for the 1/320th to prove it. The first time Strickland's platoon got hit, he saw a young artilleryman burst out crying. The soldier screamed again, "I didn't sign up for this shit." In general, Strickland thought, the lowest ranking first time soldiers adjusted to the stress better than the more experienced artillerymen because the rookies had no expectations from prior deployments. Because of Strickland's experience and uncanny ability to avoid IEDs, soldiers continually asked him to walk point on their patrols. He chose to walk 10 to 15 feet ahead of everyone else so that he could carefully identify the best route, and so that if he did make a mistake, it would cost one life instead of several. He was ultimately wounded and medevaced to Kandahar airfield 4 times. Each time as he recovered in the hospital, a doctor would ask Strickland if he wanted to go back or go home. "What am I going to say?" he thought. He went back. Day after day, in platoon after platoon, they shouldered their load, stepped out on presence patrols, and hoped for the best. They walked past villagers near their outposts who were neither helpful nor hostile. One elder near Strickland's base kept a pigeon that he would let fly every time a platoon departed, apparently to let the Taliban know they were on the march. So, one more theme of our struggle, which was our failure to identify and carry out a successful political strategy to complement our emphasis on military action. Here's another contradiction in this history that just keeps recurring in the story. General after general goes to command, American general after American general goes to command the war in Afghanistan, and they will say in public, there is no purely military solution to this war. There is not going to be a battlefield victory. We're going to batter the Taliban for the purpose of getting them to the negotiating table. I think it was David Petraeus who said, you can't capture and kill your way out of an industrial strength insurgency, which is certainly what the Taliban represented by 2011. But year after year, notwithstanding this acknowledgement, it was military action that was prioritized and resourced, and the diplomatic and political strategy languished. Richard Holbrooke, who had hoped to negotiate an end to the war, died in December 2010. And in the months before his death, he wrote a memo to Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State. It hasn't been published, but I was able to get a hold of it for the book. He said, this is December 2010, our current strategy will not succeed. Even though everyone paid lip service to the proposition that counterinsurgency required a mixed civilian-military strategy, last year the military dominated and defined the choices. There is a fundamental flaw in our strategy, the mismatch between our stated objectives and the time and resources allocated to achieve them. The best that can be hoped for is a bloody stalemate. Now, in September 2010, President Obama did authorize secret negotiations with the Taliban. He was persuaded by Doug Lute, the war czar, and also Holbrooke's successors at the State Department, that there was a viable channel. The Taliban had identified a man named Tayyip Aga as their political negotiator, the head of their political commission. Tayyip Aga had been talking to the Germans. The Germans set up a meeting with him and some envoys from the United States in a safe house outside of Munich in the autumn of 2010. But the war was grinding along. There were really several wars operating independently. The Pentagon had its war. Within that war, the Marines had their war. The Special Forces had their war. The CIA had its war, primarily the drone campaign across the border in Pakistan. And here was the State Department working out of this group called the Conflict Resolution Cell, which was so secret that even people at the cabinet level didn't know about it if they didn't have a need to know about it. And so the Germans say to the National Security Council staff, look, Tayyip Aga, he's willing to go to this meeting to talk with you about a path to peace, but he's worried because a lot of Taliban have come to meetings with Americans and then gotten snatched and sent off to Guantanamo. And he's a little bit worried that he's being set up for this to happen. And so the National Security Council staff goes to President Obama and reports this message from the Germans. And President Obama says, well, look, tell the Germans to tell Tayyip Aga that I'm offering my personal guarantee that this is not going to happen to him, that he's going to come to this meeting where all we're going to do is talk. And so the National Council staff, Security Council staff go back, and they relay this message to the Germans, and then they have a meeting amongst themselves, and they say, okay, just to be safe, let's not tell the CIA about this meeting, because if they know what plane he's on and when he's going to be at the safe house, you never know. He could be on some target list. There could be some, like, automated snatch thing that happens, so let's just not tell them about it. And I thought, wow, noted. We should all be careful out there. So the negotiations went on for 2.5 years. It's a fascinating story. A lot of information, a lot of ideas and insights were exchanged. They collapsed for a number of reasons. Partly, I don't think that the U.S. really resourced the talks with the whole of government, with the kind of full commitment of whatever leverage and strengths the United States has in the world. You know, you look at the Obama administration's diplomatic achievements, the agreement with Iran that was carried out with China and Russia and European allies, the reversal of decades of policy in Cuba. So this was an administration that could get really hard things done when it put everything into it. But it's frustrating as a chronicler of the Afghan conflict to see that this was really not the case with the negotiations or the political and diplomatic strategy around this war, where the stakes were so high and where young Americans were fighting and dying. The talks failed in part because Hamid Karzai was frustrated and didn't want them to succeed, and they failed in part because ISI, the Pakistanis, wanted the seat at the table, and that undermined their prospects. So there's more that we can talk about, but I'll wrap up because I want to take your questions. The Trump administration is the third to carry this war forward. They've changed a few aspects of policy, withdrawn aid from Pakistan. They've made declarations that we're going to stay forever to fight to the last terrorist in the hope that this resolve will somehow weaken the Taliban or their supporters in Pakistan. They've loosened the rules of engagement, dropped more bombs last year than the couple of years before. But there are 10 to 15,000 American combat troops plus Afghan forces. And That compares to 150,000, as I said, international combat troops at the peak. So with a tenth of as many international troops and Afghan forces that are undermined by illiteracy and factionalism and the fact that it's a young army, doesn't have much of a history in its current form, it's very difficult to see how these maps will change. It is a bloody stalemate. And I think in 2021, whoever the next president to be inaugurated is, whether that's President Trump being re-inaugurated or someone else, I think this war will still be going on. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Steve Cole is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Director at S, The CIA and America's Secret War in Afghanistan and Pakistan, 2001 to 2016. He spoke at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium on February 15th. His appearance was co-presented by the Elliott Bay Book Company and Town Hall Seattle. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. And stay current with us by subscribing to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in again soon.